This TFMR podcast is brought to you by your friends at JM Bullion. Visit jmbullion.com for all your gold and silver bullion needs. Well, happy Thursday to everybody at TFMR. It's Wednesday, September the 1st. You're listening to this on Thursday, September the 2nd. This is, of course, your Thursday conversation. One of those things we like to do almost every week. Where we bring in somebody, kind of pick their brain for a few minutes and get up to speed on all kinds of different topics. The topic today is going to be kind of dollar focused. And to that end, who better could I bring in than Brent Johnson? Brent Johnson, of course, of Santiago Capital. He's a money manager, hedge fund manager, analyst, and a guy that's, you know, if you're going to be in this business, you got to stay on top of everything. So he's generally well-versed in all of the financial ways of the world. So Brent, a guy I've known for a long time, it's great to have you back here at TFMR. Thank you.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Tell everybody, hey, before we get started, tell everybody what your day job is, would you, and how they can find information on what you do?
Yeah. So long story short, I have a wealth management business. I have about, you know, depends on how you divide it, but let's say between 12 and 15 clients. You know, very wealthy individuals where I do customized wealth management plans for them, kind of help them figure out, you know, where they're at, where they're trying to go, and, you know, what the best way is to get there. And then not only come up with the plan, but then actually implement and oversee the plan for them. So, you know, I do that with a select group of individuals. And then as part of that, also run, you know, a private fund through which these clients invest a portion of their portfolio. And then I also have clients who are invested in this fund who don't have me do the overall wealth management program. I've been doing this for a little over 20 years, and you know, it's just an amazing time in history to be doing something like this. And I just find it endlessly fascinating.
Yeah. And your website?
Yeah. So just Santiago, www.santiagocapital.com. You know, there's not much information there. It's just kind of a landing page with some background information on the firm and contact information. But, you know, I do a number of podcasts and interviews and presentations. If you go to, you know, YouTube and type in Brent Johnson or Santiago Capital, you'll get a number of things. And, you know, I'm pretty active on Twitter, you know, Santiago Capital on Twitter. The handle is Santiago AU Fund. There's numerous different ways to kind of follow me.
Yes. And follow you on Twitter. People should, if you're on Twitter, if you're in that kind of financial Twitter area, like I am, be sure you follow Brent. Great information. And he's a great guy. He's a Nebraska guy, for God's sakes. So Brent and I have been friends now for quite a while. Yep. Brent, you're, I guess, in the gold scheme of things, monetary scheme of things, a lot of people think you're the milkshake guy, right?
I am the milkshake guy. That's right.
And so I want to have
for better or worse. For better or worse, that's mine.
You know, I'm more of a malt kind of guy. I like
yeah,
malt,
yeah.
But whatever. Anyway, I this has been on my mind quite a bit lately, right? With the anniversary of, you know, Nixon closing the gold window.
Sure.
And fiat versus fiat, you know, and there's this kind of slogan out there that people throw around, well, the dollar's going to zero.
Yeah.
Well, okay. I mean, its purchasing power is down 98% or whatever, you know, since 1913. And, you know, you got all this stuff, right? But one of the things I keep coming back to is this, I don't know what the right word is, scheme that has been cooked up in the financial industry called the dollar index. So that, excuse me, when people measure the dollar even on a daily basis, they say, well, the dollar is stronger today. They're referring to the dollar index, and all the dollar index is comparing the dollar versus a basket of other fiat. And so, right. And so it gets back to, and then everything kind of goes off of that. You know, the gold price, well, gold's not going up because the dollar's hanging in there, you know, and the algos are all programmed to buy and sell gold futures off and moves off the dollar every day, you know, and all that kind of jazz. And so it seems like we're in this kind of loop, you know, where as long as the dollar's being devalued at the same rate and printed at the same rate as yen and euro and pounds and all the rest, its relative value doesn't change, and the metals don't go up. So in that vein of thought, I guess, line of thought, yeah. Let's get back to where you think this all heads ultimately. Sure. Because you've always thought that maybe the dollar would go up before all of this starts to break down.
Right. Well, so that, you know, all the stuff that you just talked about really plays into my whole, you know, dollar milkshake theory, for lack of a better term. You know, when I first started talking about this, I think probably 2018 or 19 is when I started talking about how I thought this quote unquote end game scenario would play out. One of the things I said is you're going to see dollar and gold rise together. And I had so many people tell me, that's impossible. You know, they're the inverse of each other. Gold goes up, dollar goes down, gold goes up. And that is sort of true if you just compare them to each other. But the point I was trying to make with this is that you can get into a situation in where the dollar is rising versus all other fiat currencies, and gold is rising versus all other fiat currencies. Mm-hmm. Now, whether gold rises faster than the dollar or the dollar rises faster versus gold in that scenario, in my opinion, doesn't really matter too much. The point that I'm trying to make is that, as you know, we all, anybody who's studied financial history and understands the design of the monetary system knows that over time, fiat currency loses its value. But the point I was trying to make with this is that it doesn't say only the U.S. fiat currency loses value. It's right. Fiat currency loses value. So the euro loses value. The yen loses value. The Brazilian real loses value. The Canadian dollar loses value. So this is not a strictly U.S. phenomenon. And there's a number of factors which I believe will cause the U.S. fiat currency to rise versus all the other fiat currencies. And I believe that when that happens, it has severe implications for markets in general. And I think we saw that pretty clearly in 2008 and 9. And I think we saw that pretty clearly again, you know, in late February, early March of last year.
Yep.
And so while I you know, and I think when I first started talking about this, people would say, well, let me step back for a second. And the other thing is, like, whenever somebody asks me what I think is going to happen, I will tell them what I think is going to happen. And I don't mind answering the question because I don't mind being wrong, right? But it doesn't necessarily mean it's what I want to happen. So, yeah. So there has been times over the last, call it 2 or 3, 4 years, where I've said, I think gold is going to fall and I think the dollar is going to rise. And so then people will say, why are you defending the system? The dollar is a horrible currency. It's, you know, they're stealing from us. And again, I don't necessarily want this to happen. I'm just saying I think it's going to happen. So I didn't come out and start saying that the dollar's going to go higher because I want people to go out and sell their gold. And I haven't come out over time and said, you know, I think gold might go down for a while because I want people to sell their gold. I actually don't want them to sell their gold. I actually want everybody to own some gold, and I want everybody to hold on to it because I think at some point down the road, it's really going to help them. But I've also, to the best of my ability, trying to educate people, while it might not play out the way that many people think it will, as far as the dollar just loses value and gold rockets through, you know, the stratosphere, I think it's a little bit more complicated than that. And I think when the dollar rises versus other fiat currencies, because of the way the monetary system is designed and because the whole world, not just the United States, has a lot of US dollar debt, when you get into a slowdown or some kind of a crisis, you know, assets have to get liquidated in order to get the dollars that underlie those assets in order to pay off those dollar loans. And when that happens, that can have an influence on the price of not just stocks and bonds and real estate, but it can also have, you know, an impact on the price of gold and silver. We saw that last March as well, right? You know, I think in March, gold fell, you know, a couple $100 last year. Now, yeah, it rebounded really quickly, right? And kind of took off after that. But the point I'm making is, if we do get into this scenario where the dollar runs up versus other fiat currencies, the idea that it won't impact at all, you know, silver or the miners or gold in some form, I think is wrong. It doesn't mean you need to go out and sell all those. I just say, you know, be prepared, you know, be aware that this can happen. So anyway, I that was kind of a very long ramble, and I'm not sure if I really answered your question or not, but I think it is very important to understand that while the dollar may be an absolutely horrible currency, so are all the other fiat currencies.
Right. And as long as that system remains,
right.
I mean, it makes for a rather tenuous balancing act, doesn't it?
It really does.
You're trying to manage Forex, yeah, you know, from a central bank perspective, because if the dollar really does soar, you know, begin to soar in that scenario, like you said, what it does to emerging market debt and everybody else that's a dollar debtor, could really spiral out of hand quickly. I mean, could the, you know, where you talk about the dollar going up at the end before everything begins to collapse or reset, that would almost seem like that could happen in a relatively short amount of time.
Oh, it could happen very fast. Yeah. I think it most likely will. My guess is that this way this plays out is we'll get like a run, you know, kind of like we did last year where the dollar ran up and then the central banks, the monetary authorities come out and they do some programs and they're able to push it back down. And then it'll go on another run and it'll cause a bunch of chaos and they'll put some more, you know, doohickeys on their, you know, Rube Goldberg machine that they've built. And, yeah, you know, that'll, the dollar come back down for it. And then it'll go on another run. You know, ultimately, I think it will go on a run that will just kind of make the whole system be reset or bring it down, however you want to, you know, the end game scenario, so to speak. And listen, I can be wrong on this. Just because this is my theory doesn't necessarily mean it's right. And that's why I think everybody needs to own some things like gold and maybe some land and, you know, be prepared for all different types of scenarios rather. But I think to just dismiss the idea that because the Fed is, quote unquote, printing, that the dollar is automatically going to fall, I don't necessarily think that's correct. And I think anybody who's kind of going all in on that idea could really get hurt. And that's probably why I've pounded the table so hard on this idea that the dollar could go higher. Is again, not because I want to be proven right. I mean, of course, I do want to be right. Nobody likes to be wrong. But it's more because I actually want to help people. I want people to be prepared for what can happen. And, you know, this kind of leads into something else that I've been talking about a lot recently is I feel like, and I don't know if you get this or not, Greg, but I feel like whoever I talk to in the various, and I talk to a lot of different people in a lot of different kind of camps and market segments. So I'm not just siloed in one industry necessarily. But if I talk to people in the gold world, they seem to know exactly how it's all going to play out and they're certain of it. If I talk to people in the crypto world or in the Bitcoin community, they're absolutely certain that they're right and they know how it's going to play out. If I talk to people in the deflationary camp, they're absolutely certain that they're right and, you know, how it's going to play out. And if I talk to people in the inflation camp, well, they're absolutely certain they're right. And, you know, they're all in on the inflation trade. And I just think that we're in a time that is extremely uncertain. You know, I certainly don't know what's going to happen. I have my ideas on what's going to happen, but I don't know. And I'm not certain about anything. And so I find the certainty with which everybody else is certain about that they're right, despite this timing that we're in that is very uncertain. I find that to be kind of an interesting little factoid. And the other thing I'd say is if you're out there and you're trying to figure out how to navigate this and which camp to be in, I mean, the one thing I would say is you don't really have to pick a camp. Now, if you have the ability, if you have the ability to pick one camp and you have enough liquidity or a source of income or whatever that allows you a really long timeline to just sit there and wait for your eventuality to play out, then that's fine. You're welcome to do that. But if you're not certain and you're trying to figure out which camp to be in, then put a little bit in every camp, you know, spread it around a little bit. And then when you get more clarity on one of those camps, then perhaps, you know, maybe move some more of your capital into there. But, you know, with everything kind of near its highs, it's hard for me to tell somebody to go all in on one thing right now. I just don't necessarily think this is the time to do that.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's kind of a little bit of another rambling, but I think it's important to get that point across.
Well, we don't really have a direct historical guide. I mean, you can look back to what's happened in the past and know generally how this is trending towards some type of, you know, reset that resets confidence in your medium of trade nationally and globally. But we don't know exactly how it's going to play out this time. And that's what I think is the value of what you're saying there. To that end, I wanted to ask you about something that I saw you did online. I mean, here we are at the 50th anniversary of Nixon closing the gold window. And a lot of that got a lot of people talking about Bretton Woods, you know, that established the dollar as the world's reserve currency and backed it with gold, you know, coming out of World War II. And I know you were up there for a conference with people like Rick Roman and Larry Leopard and a really diverse audience. First, I know that had to be a cool thing to attend, but what did you have any key takeaways from all the different things you heard? I mean, just was there some general things you thought or some specific things that really caught your eye?
Well, I think a couple things. First of all, it was just a really cool event. It was fun. I mean, obviously, I like talking about this kind of stuff, and this is something I think pretty deeply and study, and you know, it's not just a you know kind of a half-assed pastime for me, right? It's something that I take very seriously. So to have the opportunity to go to the place where the last you know global monetary order was decided, and have the you know at least similar conversations or debates or you know that in itself was very cool. And it's a very just being there from a historical perspective was just a great experience. The thing that I think made it kind of interesting this time was if we would have had the same conference even just 5 or 6 years ago, I don't think there would have been nearly as many people in the crypto world that were there this time. So, you know, this time, you know, there was people from the gold world, of course, there was people from the Bitcoin or the digital asset space. There was people like me and a guy named Steve Van Meter who were talking about the current system and why, and while we think it will change at some point, why we think it may last a little longer than a number of other people think it will. And so I thought that was kind of interesting. And then the other thing that I found interesting, and I will absolutely say right now, this is something that I will be very happy to be wrong about, is that I kind of got a sense that there was kind of a great, I don't want to hope, that's not the right way to say it. They were actually, most people were actually rather optimistic about the future and about a new system being in place. And I would love for them to be right. But I also got the impression that they felt that this system could happen relatively soon and relatively peacefully. And again, that is a beautiful thought, and I will be happy if that is the case. But my observations is that history, that's typically not the way it goes in history, right? I think that the system will only change after there has been a great amount of pain and a great amount of turmoil. And while, you know, you've probably heard me talk about the fourth turning before, you've probably read the book or, you know, and I think it's become kind of a popular thing. Now, a lot of people know what we're talking about when we say the fourth turning. And when I look at the last 20 years of the U.S., you know, perhaps we're in the fourth turning, but perhaps we're in the third. Perhaps we're in the third turning. Maybe we're just going into the fourth turning. And while we've had some frustrations and annoyances and some setbacks and some heartaches, I don't think that we've had the really severe pain and conflict that comes with the fourth turning. And so I actually think this is going to take longer to play out than many others. I think there's going to be more pain involved than kind of, I got the impression people at the conference thought. My other observation was that, you know, we had a number of academics there. We had a number of people in business there. Again, we had representatives of the precious metals industry, you know, the crypto industry, the fiat industry. But I at one point raised my hand and I said, how many politicians do we have here? Right? There were none. I said, how many, you know, monetary authorities do we have here? You know, there were none. And then the most important one, or one of the most important, I said, how many military leaders do we have here? And there were none, right? And I think the thing that many people either forget or just don't like to think about is that global reserve currencies, while yes, they play into economics and finance, they're really more about power than they are about either of those other two things.
Yeah.
You know, global reserve currencies are imposed on the rest of the world. It's not that somebody, the whole world just wakes up one day and says, oh, you know what? I think we're going to use the yen now. Right. Oh, that sounds like a good idea. Okay, let's switch to the yen, right? It just, I'm not saying it couldn't happen that way, but that's just historically not how it has happened. You know, you look at the role of the heirs of the global reserve currencies, and you know, went from Portugal to Spain and to France and Belgium and then the United Kingdom and the United States. And, excuse me, the reason that it went that way is that was the dominant military at the time. You know, the people in France didn't wake up one day and say, okay, we're going to use the pound as the global reserve currency. You know, it's because it was imposed on them by the hegemon, by the global power. And, you know, I do think that at some point the U.S. will lose it, but I just don't think we're going to lose it yet. And I don't think we will give it up without, you know, some severe conflict
right
happening. And again, I hate even saying that. Because if somebody will say that that's what I want to happen, and I think that, you know, the U.S. is the greatest country in the world, and we have the best military, and we deserve every, you know, blah, blah, blah. This is just the way I see it playing out. As an analyst kind of stepping back and looking at things, I can't imagine the U.S. just rolling over and giving away their world reserve currency.
Precisely.
Without using every tool in our toolbox to do so. And it just so happens that our toolbox includes aircraft carriers and missiles and B-1 bombers and, you know, da da da.
It's like the toolbox of the British Empire.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Or the Dutch.
So it doesn't mean that that toolbox can't be defeated by another toolbox.
Yeah.
It just means that that toolbox will be used, right?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, you and I were talking earlier, I think Afghanistan plays into this a little bit.
Well, and that was what I want to conclude with, Brent, because I've been talking about this for 2 weeks. People on the know on the site, I've been talking about this, I've been writing about this.
Yeah.
You know, the imposition of Bretton Woods was about reestablishing confidence, right?
Yeah.
You know, you've got to have confidence in your medium of trade, your medium of savings. And so, okay, yeah, we're going to back this one particular currency with gold, make it convertible into gold. Okay, now you feel confident to use it, you know, globally as we rebuild out of World War II. And then, you know, we don't have to rehash all of that history for the next 35 years or 40, I guess not even that, 25 years.
Yeah.
But in the 50 years since, that confidence has been maintained through military, right? Through the SWIFT system, you know, that is kind of weaponized. And so, but that's all it has now, though, is confidence. And so when I see this latest example, you know, of how that whole thing out of Afghanistan was handled and the world global perception of, you know, whether you Republican, Democrat, whether you believe this or not, just the world perception of, you know, America's commitment, you know, to certain things. And then you look at the people chasing after jets, you know, going down the tarmac, you know, all of that to me is a couple of slash wounds at confidence in the U.S. being this, I guess, hegemon going forward.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that's right. And I think it's right, but I think it doesn't tell the whole story. So let me tell you what I mean. I think, you know, for lack of a better word, let's say from, you know, after World War II up until, let's call it Vietnam, right? We were kind of sort of seen as the white knight of the world, like the shining light that's going to, you know, protect the world and, you know, bring, you know, spread democracy, et cetera, et cetera. And I think, you know, let's say in the 70s, you know, after, you know, Vietnam and into the 70s, some of that, you know, bloom started to come off the rose a little bit, right? But then we had, you know, Reagan was president, we were in the Cold War, and, you know, people still looked to the United States, maybe not to the same extent that they did, you know, 20 years earlier, but we were still kind of seen as the force for good, right? And then I think like in kind of in, you know, the 90s and into the 2000s, some people started to say, well, you know what? The U.S. is kind of a troublemaker, and they're kind of keeping us safe, but they're kind of keeping us safe from the trouble that they're causing, right?
Yeah.
And so I think to your point, like, and then I think since you know after 9/11, you know, we had the full sympathy of the world, right? And the world would have helped us do anything, and instead of, you know, using it in a positive way, we decided to go to war in the graveyard of empires, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then over the last, and we squandered all of that, right? And then the point is, I agree with you that slowly our brand, for lack of a better word, is being tarnished. And if there was a suitable alternative to the dollar, and if it was easy for the rest of the world to go to something else, I think that they would be more inclined to do so now than ever before. I guess my point is, 20 years ago, not only did they know they needed to use the dollar, but they actually wanted to use the dollar.
Right.
Whereas I would say now, they know they still need to use the dollar, but they don't really want to anymore.
Right.
So we've taken away, or we've squandered their goodwill towards us, right? But what we but we still have their need, and they still need Usador because they don't have their own thing to replace it yet. And so I guess I would say we are on the road to the dollar losing its value or its role as the global reserve currency. But I don't think because I don't think there is a suitable replacement, I don't think that it's going to happen as soon as everybody else does.
Yeah.
Now, could if everybody woke up tomorrow and said, we want to go back to a gold standard, and the rest of the world said, screw you, you United States, you can drop whatever bombs on us, you can trade sanction us, we're going back to gold, then it's gold, right? And if they did the same thing with Bitcoin, it would be Bitcoin. And if it was the same thing with the yen, it would be the yen. Again, I don't think that that's going to happen that way. I think, and I know we're probably going to run out of time here in a minute, Craig, but and the reason I think this is because the euro dollar system is not just a U.S. phenomenon. And yeah. What I mean by that is, you know, everybody knows that the U.S. has these massive debts that we can never pay off. But what a lot of people don't know is that there's another dollar system outside the United States, which is called euro dollars. And this is a system where people have all kinds of debt in dollars outside the United States. And, you know, so they have to service that debt and they have to pay off those loans. And then people will tell me, yes, but Brent, but they will just default on those loans and then they won't have to pay them back. The problem with that argument is twofold. One, if you start to default on those loans, it causes kind of a chain reaction where you can get a credit crunch where the supply of dollars falls even more.
Yeah.
But not only that, but those loans that exist outside the United States that are denominated in dollars, those are not loans that were given by U.S. banks or U.S. entities. Those are dollar loans made by international entities to other international entities. So it's a bank in France. It's a bank in Brazil. It's a commodity trading company in Japan. It's a manufacturer in China who's extending credit to its, vendors. And if you start defaulting on that dollar debt, you're not defaulting on the United States. You're taking assets away from other international entities. And so it becomes sort of, if they were to walk away from the dollar, they're kind of throwing away a bunch of assets on their balance sheet. So I'm not saying it can't happen. I'm just saying it doesn't happen as easily as many people think it does. And so while I think we're on this pretty serious path, and you do have to kind of think about what the next system is going to look like and when it's going to happen, I don't think it's going to happen as quite as quickly as other people think it's going to. So anyway, that's my little soapbox for the day.
Hey, one last thing. You had mentioned to me a book you'd read. I think so many people on the site are kind of historians they study world history and economic history, and you see how these pieces all fit together. And many of us have read The Fourth Turning, like you said, but
yes,
you had told me earlier about a book you had read earlier that you thought might be helpful too. What was that?
Yeah. My friend Mike told me about this book, and for a year he kept asking me if I'd read it yet. And I kept saying no. And he kept telling me I had to read it. I finally got around to reading it 4 or 5 months ago, and it's just fantastic. And if you like history, you'll like it, because it's called The Storm Before the Storm. It's written by a guy named Mike Duncan, and it talks about Rome. And so a lot of people, you've heard a lot of these comparisons, the fall of Rome to the fall of the United mm-hmm. States, the arrogance of Rome, the arrogance of the United States. And so many parallels are drawn. And so, I read this book with great interest, not just because I like history, but because of the parallels. This book takes place from approximately 120 BC to about 60 BC. And the number of issues that they deal with are so identical to the issues that we're dealing with now, whether it's the subsidized farming, or, the citizenship and illegal aliens, or whether it's, the numerous wars at the edge of the empire, the different political factions that are fighting with each other that lead to actually political violence. I mean, it's amazing the number of parallels. And so, from an entertainment standpoint, it's very interesting, but from a parallel standpoint, it's very interesting. But the one thing that I also find very interesting is that this book takes place while Rome was still a republic. And what I mean by that, it was still for the most part a democracy, citizens still had a vote. But at the end of this book, Rome doesn't fall. at the end of this book, it goes from being a republic to being dictatorships.
Yeah.
In other words, that's when the strong men start to rise. That's when the dictators come in. And, you know, that's when you have Pompey and, you know, Caesar and Nero. Yep. And, you know, yep. You know, that comes after. And so if you think that we're in a parallel to what's going on with Rome, then, you know, what comes after this for us is the strong man rises, or potential for the strong man to rise, or nationalism takes place, or whatever it is, right?
Yep. Yep.
And, you know, the other thing is, like many people don't realize, is that it took another 400 years for Rome to finally fall and kind of lose its empire. Now, I certainly don't think that, you know, we have another 400 years to go before we have kind of a changing of the guard, so to speak. But I guess my point is these things take a long time to play out, sometimes decades, right? And, you know, this one's been going on for 100 years now, and or 80 years, however you want to define it. And maybe it can go... Maybe it only lasts another two, but maybe it lasts another 20. I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's fascinating nonetheless, and I recommend people read the book.
Oh, the Visigoths, right? Isn't that who finally stormed Rome?
Yeah. Barbarians at the gate, right?
Might have been a little more of a challenge back in the 5th century or whatever than it would be today. Things move a little faster. But your point is well taken. And again, even in more recent history, economies in decline, people get desperate. Yep. You turn to a Mussolini type.
Yeah, that's the environment. And, you know, this goes back to Afghanistan too, right? I mean, think about all the people either in the military or former military people who are sitting here saying, Jesus, we just left Americans in Afghanistan. The way we pulled out, you know, is just horrible. And I think a lot of those people actually wanted to get out of Afghanistan, but they hate the way we did it. They hate the way our reputation looks. And if, and I'm not saying there is, but if there is somebody in the military ranks who's a great leader and who just hates seeing what's going on and has ever had the desire to kind of take a position of power, you know, now he's got the perfect, you know, environment to do it in. And again, I'm not saying I want this to happen. I'm just sitting back and looking at this saying, wow, this is something that guy could point to and say, you know, it's like Jack Nicholson and A Few Good Men. But who's going to do it? You?
Yeah.
You need me. You need me to do this for you. And most people will say, yeah, we do. You know, or a lot of people will say that.
Enough.
So anyway,
enough people,
right?
Yeah. And like you said, it's like, you know, we talk about when gold finally, you know, whatever gets revalued or properly valued or whatever, you know, and all this happens and you think, but nobody's pulling for that. Right.
Yeah.
It's your ship in the storm, but it's not like, oh, I can't wait to see, you know, the civil unrest that happens when the dollar collapses and come on.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I said. You know, be careful what you wish for.
Right. Nobody's looking forward to that. We're just talking about protecting ourselves and trying to figure it out in the meantime, so we have time to prepare. Brent, nobody does a better job of studying all this stuff, putting it in English and warning people than you do. Again, Brent Johnson, Santiago Capital.
Thanks for having me, Craig. I always love talking to you.
Oh, it's always fun. And I've in the 12 years I've been doing this, I've been able to meet so many people that I would never have met otherwise. And I'm honored to consider you a friend. And so, because I've learned so much from you, and keep doing what you're doing, my friend. And we're going to have to keep in touch. And because, you know, things move slowly, but they also seem to be moving faster. Yeah,
exactly. Okay, great talking to you, Craig.
Always good talking to you, my friend. And thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll have another Thursday conversation next week.